All that's left now are the SNL parodies, the hot takes, and, you know, the voting. Dissecting the economics from last night's presidential debate. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, filling in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, October 20th. Thank you for being here today, and thank the stars. There will be no more presidential debates this year. A quick and unscientific poll of social media today reveals that the winner of last night's third and final debate was moderator Chris Wallace. The Fox News presenter ran a tight ship. He asked a lot of policy questions, and they included this one on the national debt.
Our national debt as a share of the economy, our GDP, is now 77%. That's the highest since just after World War II. But the nonpartisan Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget says, Secretary Clinton, under your plan, debt would rise to 86% of GDP over the next 10 years. Mr. Trump, under your plan, they say it would rise to 105% of GDP over the next 10 years. Question is, why are both of you ignoring this problem?
Now, we're stopping him there because neither candidate did much to answer either the question or the problem. Hillary Clinton said her policies would not add to the debt, and she moved on quickly. Donald Trump didn't mention the debt at all. That may seem strange when you think of all those fights we've had over raising the debt ceiling these last few years. But maybe the candidates are on to something. It turns out the size of our national debt isn't such a big deal, at least for now. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
The thing about numbers, you can slice them and dice them to make them support whatever point you're trying to make. Politicians are especially good at that. When University of Georgia economist William Lestrap sees this, he just shakes his head.
When politicians start talking about the federal government debt, it's very easy to talk about the big numbers, but you need to keep those numbers in perspective.
Lestrap says the $18 trillion national debt works out to around $56,500 per American. He says, yes, those are big numbers, but
I don't see any possibility of an imminent default.
In other words, we can handle the debt. Then there's the deficit. Think about it this way. The debt is everything we owe. The deficit is how much we charge in any one year. Lestrap says both are manageable now. He does worry about the future, as do other economists like Veronique de Rougy at George Mason University.
I mean, the national debt absolutely matters.
De Rougy says while the current debt is high,
it's not even just like that we're at a high level, is we're heading towards something that's much higher.
Because as baby boomers age, the government will have to pay out more and more for Social Security and Medicare. The national debt will balloon, but slowly, says Mark Goldwine with the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
It's not a hurricane hitting your house. It's termites. Right? So this is going to eat at us little by little if we do nothing to stop it.
So yeah, the debt isn't going to blow the roof off our economy anytime soon, but it does matter. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Now, before last night's debate, Donald Trump had a pregame show all his own on Facebook Live. There was an after show there as well, and it featured the hashtag TrumpTV. That only fueled speculation that Trump may be working on a new conservative media outlet, and that made us wonder, in the crowded world of cable channels, not to mention on-demand television, what does it take to get a brand new network off the ground? Gigi Duban has this report.
If you were, you know, just casually thinking about creating your own TV or cable network, there are a few key things you need. Number one, a brand. But that's not all. Oprah Winfrey had a brand and a popular syndicated talk show. But when she made the leap to her own network, let's just say
it wasn't an overnight success.
Sam Craig heads NYU's Entertainment, Media, and Technology program. It took OWN 4 years and $500 million in investment before it turned a profit. Second thing you need? Lots of amazing content. Basically, you have to stand out from the nearly 2,000 cable channels already out there. Craig says it takes time to build an audience.
And it takes an upfront investment to make it happen.
How much?
Well, I mean, the short answer is hundreds of millions of dollars to do it correctly.
Eric Brannon is a tech and media analyst at IHS. TV networks get their revenue through ads, yes, but also from carriage fees. These are paid by cable and satellite service companies per subscriber. It might be 10 cents, but for a network to pay off the enormous cost of good programming, it's got to have millions of eyeballs. And without a following, pay TV operators like cable companies won't want to pick up your network and pay your carriage fees. So
getting in front of millions of homes is going to be a real challenge for you.
Brannon says it's kind of a chicken and egg situation. John Tarnoff co-runs the entertainment management program at Carnegie Mellon. He says the best platform for someone like Donald Trump isn't a TV or cable network.
It's social media. I mean, I think that's where he excels.
The Donald Trump Network brought to you by Facebook? Who knows? I'm Gigi Dubin for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, that was a short little rally. Stocks down today after 2 days of gains. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As in so many elections, the number one economic issue this year is J-O-B-S. That spells jobs. Candidates suddenly really care about your feelings about your current job situation. So what are those feelings? Well, at the risk of sounding like mealy-mouthed politicians, they are mixed. In our newest Economic Anxiety Index poll, done in conjunction with Edison Research Company, we found that a lot more people are worried about losing their jobs than even a year ago. But more than half are very confident they can find their next jobs. So in a world where Americans are both anxious and confident at the same time, only Marketplace's Scott Tong can attempt to explain.
Mike Cahill is a union pipe worker at a fuel processing plant outside Philadelphia. He fears losing his job in the next year because his type of construction work could fall off, he says. We caught up to him by cell phone at his lunch hour.
Are we in a boom-bust cycle? Is all this work going to start wrapping up at the same time? You know, it could be that this time next year, there's substantial unemployment in the building trades.
In our poll, just 14% of people shared the same job loss fear as Mike Cahill a year ago. But today, that fear is doubled. And that anxiety doesn't sync up with the broader job market, which is doing well, says economist Andrew Chamberlain at the online job site Glassdoor.
There's very little basis in reality for fear. The rate of layoffs is really at an all-time low. Claims for unemployment insurance are the lowest since the 1970s. There's a near record number of job openings, 5.5 million unfilled jobs.
So what gives? Well, several people we talked to suspect an election year blathering effect. All this talk of jobs supposedly shipping out, fleeing, quote, taken away from us like babies, end quote, may be warping our reality. Rutgers labor economist William Rogers.
Both candidates, particularly one candidate, is raising a level of discourse that is really creating fear. I think it's more of a distortion.
Perception shapes reality. But here's the twist. More than half our respondents say if they do lose a job, they're actually very confident in finding the next one. Here's solar energy installer Dan Marcotte on Long Island.
I'm sure I'll be able to get a job, but the problem is I will probably take about a cut in pay, you know, make about half as much as I'm making now type of thing. That seems like what the jobs are out there now.
And that's an increasing reality for Americans with mid-level skills and middle incomes, a hollowing out of the middle, says Linda Barrington at the Institute for Compensation Studies at Cornell.
More workers who, when they lose a job, are going to be more likely pushed down. That's a longer run trend that we've seen since the Great Recession and throughout the recovery.
That is, there are jobs to be found. Whether they're good jobs is another question. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Okay, no more politics for a bit. Now I am going to say the words Abercrombie and Fitch, and I'm betting you're going to start thinking of cologne, half-clothed teenagers, and maybe a crushing fear that you're not hot enough to shop there. And all of that was a deliberate brand strategy, even the hot or not part. But fast forward out of high school and realize it gets better. 2016 Abercrombie & Fitch wants to be more inclusive, maybe to win back customers who went to American Eagle and Forever 21, which were both cheaper and, you know, not so mean. Elizabeth Holmes is a reporter at The Wall Street Journal who wrote about the brand shift. Elizabeth, hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. How are you?
I am great, and I'm so excited to talk about this story because Abercrombie & Fitch was sort of the bane of my teenage and later I don't know, early 20s years, as I think is the case with so many. And so now I feel like we are in the judge's seat about this turnaround.
I'm right there with you. When I was in high school and college, it was this intimidating place to shop. It was the mean girl at the mall. You know, they used sex in this very aggressive way. They only hired attractive people to work in their stores. They didn't stock sizes that were outside of like a regular sort of small, medium, extra small range. And now, after, you know, the rethinking of the millennial generation and what they're looking for from a shopper and frankly, plummeting sales, they have made a huge about face and they want to be seen as an inclusive brand.
Yeah. How recent is this sort of change of heart? At what point does Abercrombie & Fitch go, man, this mean girl thing, which is genius, by the way, good coinage, this mean girl thing is just not working for us?
Well, their CEO, who sort of led them from 1992 all the way through 2014, was sort of the architect of this brand and their success. And for a long time, we should point out, they were very successful.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, around 2014, when sales were really falling, the CEO abruptly left. And they brought in a whole new executive team, and they've been trying to sort of regroup and restaff and reposition themselves. And mm-hmm. now they're trying to be seen as this brand that's like a casual luxury brand for millennials who loved it in high school and are now out in the working world and have a little bit more money to spend and are looking for clothes to wear.
And so what does the plan include? I mean, I am fascinated by the fact that they're scrubbing the photos from the website, getting rid of the Instagram pictures. What is this going to entail?
That was the most millennial thing I think they're doing. They wiped their social media channels.
That's huge.
You know, like after you go through a breakup when you're, you know, a high schooler, you're like, delete the photos. I don't want any evidence out there. And they said, you know, we're going to put forth something that's just a total brand overhaul. And a lot of the styling is kind of looser. There's less makeup on the models. There's a lot more clothes on the models. So it's less about, you know, shirtless dudes. You know, that said, their stores are still very much the same. I don't know when the last time you wandered into an Abercrombie was, but they're still heavily scented. Mm. They're darker. You know, they have that sort of high school feel, and they're working to correct that too. They're trying to release a new store prototype early next year. So that is sort of waits to be seen.
What I thought was interesting is that a lot of people you talk to don't have great feelings, feel a little bullied by that brand. How likely is the marketing turnaround to succeed?
Well, there are some brands that people get really upset that they're not doing well, and they sort of cheer for them to come back. I wouldn't say Abercrombie is one of those brands. There are a lot of hard feelings there. But there are also those people who remember that it was the brand for the cool kids in high school, and they feel a little sentimental about it, and they're open to giving it another shot. I think it's extremely challenging for clothing retailers of all age targets out there, but there's nothing more than the teen and millennial shopper that is, you know, that they are looking to spend their money elsewhere. People want to spend it on experiences. They want to spend it on things they can Instagram, frankly. And so if you're already a brand that, you know, might have some negative feelings toward it, that's sort of two hurdles to clear then.
That's Elizabeth Holmes, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. I am looking forward to all the emails from people who love Abercrombie & Fitch, because we know you're out there too. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up,
there are thousands of people sitting in jail on minor cases, essentially because they are poor.
What happens when you're arrested but you can't afford bail? We'll find out in just a moment. But first, let's do the numbers. Numbers are down, but they're not way down. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dipped 40 points, 0.2% to close at 18,162. The NASDAQ fell 4 points, less than 0.1% to end at 5241. The S&P 500 lost 2 points, 0.1% to finish at 2141. Verizon rang down 2.4% after posting weak quarterly revenue and gaining fewer internet service subscribers than a year ago. Other telecom stocks also fell. AT&T shed 1.8%. Sprint slowed 2.3%. T-Mobile moved down 0.5%. Several big name companies fell on worse than expected quarterly results, but results bolstered some stocks. Credit card issuer American Express rushed up 9%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.7%. And you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Everyone these days is looking for some sort of edge, but it's no surprise that Silicon Valley isn't satisfied with five-hour energy drink and nap pods. The culture famous for hacking everything is also super into hacking the body, and specifically the brain. And of course, there's a startup in this story too. Nutrobox is one of those subscription mail services, but this one isn't filled with makeup samples or gear. It's filled with pills that are supposed to enhance cognition. It's $135 a month for a month's supply of nootropics. Alex Morris is a contributing editor at New York Magazine. She profiled the company in a piece titled The Pill Freaks of Silicon Valley. And I asked her what you are all thinking right this second. What the heck are nootropics?
Nootropics are cognitive enhancers, and they fall into this sort of gray area between pharmaceuticals like Adderall and scheduled drugs like LSD. Although the people who are trying nootropics at this point are people who often have dabbled in both off-label use of Adderall and illicit use of LSD, oftentimes in microdoses. Mm. So basically, these are people who are interested in messing around with their brain chemistry.
Okay, and so then along comes this company, Nootrobox.
Yeah, so basically the company came about because the two founders, Jeffrey Wu and Michael Brandt, had friends who were sort of involved in this underground community of trying nootropics. And what this meant was ordering compounds off the internet, often from overseas, and you would try it.
Good idea.
And this was all over Reddit. It was becoming a little bit of a thing to do in Silicon Valley. So basically they realized that if there were people going through all these steps, then there would be a market for a fully vetted pill.
How much of that do you think is Silicon Valley culture? I mean, you hear these stories, they may be apocryphal, but you can certainly see this interest in body hacking all around the valley. There's everything from body implants to genome mapping to Soylent, you know, all these ways to be faster, better, smarter, little baskets of pills at every startup. How much of that do you think influenced, for one thing, how much funding they got and their sort of current customer base?
I think it did a lot. I talked to one Nutrobox customer that said that taking drugs and pills to work better was actually kind of a badge of honor in this culture and this environment. And I think that there's this sense that anything you can do to get an edge on the competition is worth doing or worth trying.
What do you think about the broader potential market? I mean, certainly, you know, in the past few years, we've seen Red Bull and 5-Hour Energy and all these different caffeine drinks. You know, it seems clear that everybody's looking for some sort of boost, even if it's just to like stay awake, much less get ahead at work. Do you think that there is a broader market for this, or is it just too weird for people?
Look, I talked to a scientist who was like, this, you know, it's not a fantasy that there could be a chemical compound out there that would increase human cognition in a way that's safe. He wasn't sure that we had found that compound yet. If it could be proven that these were safe and effective, why wouldn't we?
So did you try them?
Yeah. Nootropics.
You did.
I did try them.
Was it?
Yeah.
In my mind, it's like Limitless, you know, that show, like just, the movie. Like you try it, the whole world changes and you're way smarter. Did that happen?
I wish. Uh-huh. Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things is Nutrobox has a product called Go Cubes, which are a mix of caffeine and L-theanine. L-theanine, there's a lot of it in green tea. It's actually sort of calming. Mm. I think those work. I you know, will pop one in the afternoon now. And they're also, for something that kind of tastes like gelatinous coffee, they're surprisingly delicious.
Alex Morris is contributing editor at New York Magazine and Rolling Stone. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
You already know this from Law and Order, but in this country, when you are arrested on a criminal charge, a couple of things can happen. You might be released on your own recognizance, you might remain in jail until your trial, or you might post bail and get out that way. In fact, bail is one of the most widely recognized tools of our justice system. But increasingly, politicians, legal advocates, even the Justice Department are arguing that money bail and poverty don't mix. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports.
So back in November of 2014, Ed, we're not using his real name because of unique details of his case, he was 31 years old and he was riding his bike by his housing complex in the Bronx.
Got off the bike, I parked it right there, and I sat down.
He's checking Facebook and he sees two officers across the street.
2 minutes later, they walked over to me. He's like, oh, let me see your ID. I told him I live here. I gave it to him. That's what they tell you, that, you know, you comply. That's what I did. I mean, he didn't even look at it, my name or nothing. He just put it in his front pocket, get on the wall. So I'm like, what did I do? I didn't do anything.
What Ed had done, technically, was ride his bike on the sidewalk for a few seconds, which is illegal in New York. He also questioned the cops, which he says enraged them.
So I was like, I did youth police academy. You know, I know the procedure. And that was not it. I said, excuse me, why am I getting locked up for riding a bike?
Ed was charged with riding a bike on the sidewalk, resisting arrest, and assaulting a police officer, even though he says all he did was ride his bike and ask questions. His bail was set.
$1,500.
The charge of assaulting a police officer was dropped, and the bail was reduced to $500. Now, at the time, Ed was selling tickets for tour buses for work, living paycheck to paycheck, not making a whole lot.
In a month, probably like, let's see, $600.
In New York, when bail is set at just $500, only 17% of people pay it. Ed certainly could not. He stayed in jail.
It's like you're kidnapped. It smells worse than a hospital. It's like a dirty hospital.
There are thousands of people sitting in jail on minor cases, essentially because they are poor. And because they're poor, they can't afford the bail.
David Feige is chairman of the board of the Bronx Freedom Fund. They post bail for low-income people. Bail's effect on poor people is a problem that charities and several state governments have increasingly tried to grapple with in recent years. The U.S. Department of Justice has argued that fixed money bail for poor people violates their 14th Amendment rights to equal protection. While in jail, Ed lost his job.
It's been 8 days. The days was going by. And like, if you have a job, if you're missing for 2 days, you don't longer have a job. You got to pay rent by the week. Your life is in a tailspin.
Now, Ed can actually get out of jail anytime he wants. All he has to do is plead guilty. No need for a drawn-out trial. They'll just find him and release him with a record.
So it's like, oh, you're going to take the deal for your freedom? But I'm like, I'm innocent. I didn't do anything. I know in my heart.
So Ed stays in jail.
If you're incarcerated, you're faced with a Hobson's choice. Plead guilty and get out of jail, or maintain your innocence and stay in.
Feige says statistics show not everyone sticks to their guns like Ed when faced with this choice.
The folks that we're unable to post bail for, essentially 100% of them, very close to 100% of them, wind up pleading guilty. Once we post bail, more than 50% of the cases in which we post bail are dismissed, outright, just dismissed.
The Bronx Freedom Fund ended up posting Ed's bail for him, and he showed up to court more than a dozen times as his case wound through the system. Feige says it's an illusion that bail is the only thing keeping people accused of low-level crimes from skipping court.
We post bail, everybody still comes back. Our return rates are 97%.
Bail is being unfairly painted as sort of a debtor's prison issue.
Jeff Clayton is policy director of the American Bail Coalition, a trade association. He says the number of people in jail because they can't afford bail is overstated and believes bail is ultimately fair.
Bail is a liberty promotion institution as old as this nation.
There are around 450,000 Americans in jail who haven't been convicted of a crime. How many of them are there because they are poor is hotly contested and varies from place to place. Data from L.A. suggests it's 14% there. A New Jersey study from 2013 put the number at 39%. Advocates say it's higher. By any measure, it's tens of thousands of people on any given day. In the end, Ed's case was dismissed. All of it. The bike riding, the resisting arrest. In the 2 years it took to clear his name, he had two job offers rescinded because of his still open record. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
There are alternatives to bail. We'll look at Washington, D.C.'s solution in part two of our series tomorrow. This final note before we go, a note on the presidential debates, in fact. Yes, they have been fodder for headlines, endless analysis, and late-night comedy shows, but this has also been a banner election cycle for merchandise. And last night was no exception. Donald Trump's comments that there were some, quote, bad hombres immigrating to America illegally, and his reference to Hillary Clinton as such a nasty woman, promptly spawned internet memes galore and also things to buy with those words on them. On Google, Redbubble, Etsy, and Cafe Press this morning, you could already order pins, t-shirts, custom embroidered pillows, and coffee mugs. This great country of ours is just full of entrepreneurs. We've got some examples of the post-debate merch on our website, marketplace.org. All right, we got to go. Today, the Dow dipped 40 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ fell 4 points, less than 0.1%. The S&P 500 lost 2 points, 0.1%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, George Shudson, Suzanne Levy, Andrea Seabrook, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I am Molly Wood. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.